This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Sunburn, a novel by Laura Lippman, performed by Susan Bennett. Part 1. Smoke. Chapter 1. June 11th, 1995. Belleville, Delaware. It's the sunburned shoulders that get him. Pink, peeling. The burn is 2 days old, he gauges. Earned on Friday. Painful to the touch yesterday. Today, an itchy soreness that's hard not to keep fingering, probing, as she's doing right now in an absent-minded way. The skin has started sloughing off. Soon those narrow shoulders won't be so tender. Why would a redhead, well into her 30s, make such a rookie mistake? And why is she here, sitting on a bar stool, 45 miles inland, in a town where strangers seldom stop on a Sunday evening? Belleville is the kind of place where people are supposed to pass through, and soon they won't even do that. They're building a big bypass so the beach traffic won't have to slow for the speed trap on the old Main Street. He saw the construction vehicles, idle on Sunday, on his way in. Places like this bar/restaurant, the High Ho, are probably going to lose what little business they have. High Ho. H-I-G-H. A misprint? Was it supposed to be H-E-I-G-H? Hi-ho? And if so, was it for the seven dwarfs, heading home from the mines at day's end, or for the Lone Ranger riding off into the sunset? Neither one makes much sense for this place. Nothing about this makes sense. Her shoulders are thin, pointy, hunched up so close to her ears that they make him think of wings. The front of her pink and yellow sundress is quite a contrast, full and round. She carries herself as if she doesn't want to attract any male attention, at least not tonight. On the front, he can't help noticing as he slides on a bar stool, she's not so pink. The little strip of skin showing above the relatively high-necked dress has only the faintest hint of color. Ditto her cheeks. It is early June, with a breeze that makes it easy to forget how strong the sun is already. Clearly a modest type, she wears a one-piece, so there's probably a deep hue of red to go with those shoulders. Yesterday, fingerprints pressed there would have left white marks. He wonders if she's meeting someone here, someone who will rub cream into the places she can't reach. He would be surprised if she is. More surprised if she's up for leaving with a stranger, not shocked by either scenario. Sure, she gives off a prim vibe, but those are the ones you have to watch out for. One thing's for sure. She's up to something. His instincts for this stuff can't be denied. He doesn't go in hard. He's not that way. Doesn't have to be. If that doesn't sound too vain, it's just a fact. He's a Ken doll kind of guy, if Ken had a great year-round tan. Tall and muscular, with even features, pale eyes, dark hair. Women always assume that Ken wants a Barbie, but he prefers his women thin and a little skittish. In his downtime, he likes to hunt deer, bow and arrow. He goes to the woods of western Maryland, where he can spend an entire day sitting in a tree, waiting. And he loves it. Tom Petty was wrong about that. The waiting's not the hardest part. Waiting can be beautiful, lush, full of possibility. When he was a kid, growing up in the Bay Area, his ahead-of-the-curve beat parents put him in this study at Stanford, where he was asked to sit in a room with a marshmallow for 15 minutes. He would get two if he didn't eat the one while he waited. He had asked, "How long do I have to sit here for three?" They laughed. He didn't learn until he was in his 20s that he was part of some study that was trying to determine if there's a correlation between success and a kid's ability to manage the desire for instant gratification. He still thinks it was unfair that the experiment wasn't organized in a way that allowed a kid to get three marshmallows for sitting twice as long as anyone else. He has left two stools between them, not wanting to crowd her. But he makes sure she hears when he orders a glass of wine. That catches her attention, asking for wine instead of beer in a place like this. That was the idea catching her attention. She doesn't speak, but glances sideways when he asks the blonde behind the bar what kind of wine they serve. He doesn't break balls over the selection, which is red and white. Literally, "We have red and we have white." He doesn't bat an eyelash when they serve him the red cold. Not a sommelier-ordained 60-degree cold, but straight from the fridge cold. He takes a sip, summons the barmaid back, and says, oh so politely, "You know what? I'm happy to pay for this, but it's not to my taste. May I have a beer?" He glances at the taps. Goose Island. Another quick sideways flick of her eyes, then back to her own drink. Amber, rocks. Wherever she's going tonight, it's not far from here. He looks into his own drink and says out loud, as if to himself, what kind of an asshole orders red wine in a tavern in Belleville, Delaware? "I don't know," she says, not looking at him. "What kind of an asshole are you?" Garden variety. Or so his exes. One wife for a span of 5 years, maybe seven, eight girlfriends. Which strikes him as a respectable number for a 38-year-old man, always told him. "You from around here?" "Define from." She's not playing, she's retreating. "Do you live here?" "I do now." "That sunburn. I just assumed you were someone who got a day or two of beach, was headed back to Baltimore or D.C. "No, I'm living here." He sees a flicker of surprise on the barmaid's face. "As of when?" "Now." A joke, he thinks. A person doesn't just stop for a drink in a strange town and decide to live there. Not this town. It's not like she's rolled into Tuscany or Oaxaca, two places he knows well and can imagine a person saying, "Yes, here, this is where I'm going to plant myself." She's in Belleville, Delaware, with its saggy, sad Main Street, a town of not even 2,000 people surrounded by cornfields and chicken farms. Does she have connections here? The barmaid sure doesn't treat her like a local, even a potential one. To the barmaid, blonde and busty with a carefully nurtured tan, the redhead is furniture. The barmaid is interested in him, however, trying to figure out whether he's passing through tonight or hanging around, which has not yet been determined. "Let me know if you want someone to give you the skinny on this place," the barmaid says to him with a wink. "It would take all of 5 minutes." Barmaids and waitresses who flirt this overtly make him a little nervous. Bringing a man food or beer is intimate enough. He lets both women alone, drinks his beer, watches the inevitable Orioles game on the inevitable TV with the inevitable shimmy in its reception. The team is good again, or at least better. As the redhead's third drink reaches its last quarter inch, he settles up, leaves without saying goodbye to anyone, goes to his truck in the gravel parking lot, and sits in the dark, not hiding, because there's no better way to be found than to try to hide. 10 minutes later, the redhead comes out. She crosses the highway, heads to the old-fashioned motel on the other side, the kind they call a motor court. This one is named Valley View, although there's no valley and no view. The hi-ho, the Valley View, Main Street. It's like this whole town was put together from some other town's leftovers. He waits 15 minutes, then enters the little office at the end and inquires if there's a room, despite the big red vacancy sign filling the window. "How many nights?" the clerk, a pencil-necked guy in his 30s, asks. "Open-ended. I can give you a credit card if you like." "Funny, you're the second person today to ask for an open-ended stay." He doesn't have to ask who the first one was. He makes a note to himself that the chatty clerk will be chatty about him, too. "You need my credit card?" "Cash is fine, too. If you commit to a week, we can give you the room for $250. We don't get many people Monday through Friday. But, you know, there's no kitchenette, no refrigerator. You gotta eat your meals out, or bring stuff in that won't spoil." He adds, "If the maid sees stuff sitting out, she'll tell me. I don't want ants or roaches." "Can I keep a cooler in the room?" "As long as it doesn't leak." He hands the credit card over. "I can give you a better rate if you pay cash," the guy says, clearing his throat. $220. Guy's got some sort of scam going. Must be skimming the cash payments, but what does he care? He can last a long time in a place that's $220 a week, even if there's no refrigerator or stove. He wonders how long she can last. Chapter 2. She steps out of room 5 into a bright, hot morning, unseasonably hot, just as the weekend at the beach had been. But at least there, the breeze from the ocean took the edge off. People said how lucky it was, getting such a hot day in early June, when the water is too cold for anyone but the kids. School not even out yet, lines at the most popular restaurants were manageable. Lucky, people kept saying, as if to convince themselves. Lucky, so lucky. Is there anything sadder than losers telling themselves that they're fortunate? She used to be that way. But not anymore. She calls things the way they are, starting with herself. When Greg had started talking about a week at the beach, she had assumed a rental house in Rehoboth, or Dewey. Maybe not on the beach proper, but at least on the east side of the highway. Well, they had been close to the beach, but it was Fenwick, on the bay side, and it was a 2-story cinder block with 4 small apartments that were basically studios. One big rectangular room for them and Janny, a galley kitchen, a bathroom with only a shower, no tub, and ants. Wavy black lines of ants everywhere. "It's what was available last minute," Greg said. She amended in her head, "It's what was available last minute, if you're cheap." There had to be a better place to stay along the Delaware shore, even last minute. Janny couldn't sleep unless the room was in complete blackout, so they kept her up late, to 9 or 10, because the alternative was to go to bed together at 8 and lie there in the dark without touching. The first night, about 2 a.m., Greg made a move. Maybe a year or two ago, it would have been sexy, trying to go at it silently in the dark. But it had been a long time since she found anything about Greg sexy. No. She'll wake up. "We could give her a little Benadryl." That had given her pause. Made her wonder if she should change her plans. But no, she had to go ahead. The next day she did ask him if he would really do that, give Janny a Benadryl. He insisted he was joking. She decided to believe him. If she didn't believe him, she would have to stay, and there was no way she could stay. That was Saturday. She put a gauzy white shirt over her bathing suit, but even that irritated her shoulders. She huddled under the umbrella, shivering as if cold. A bad sunburn can do that, give you chills. Greg played in the surf with Janny. He was good with her. She wasn't just telling herself that. He was good. Good enough. As good as she needed him to be. They went to the boardwalk, the smaller one up at Rehoboth, which was better for little kids like Janny than the one in Ocean City. Greg tried to win Janny the biggest stuffed panda he could, but he never got above the second-tier prize. Do the math, she wanted to tell him. For the $20 he was spending, shooting water guns at little targets, tossing rings, he could buy Janny something much better. On Sunday, she watched them build a sandcastle. About 11 a.m., she said she had had too much sun. She was going back to the house. House, huh? Place. The highway was busy. It seemed to take forever to get across. She changed into her sundress, packed a bag, the duffel, which had wheels, and wrote a note to go with the one she had brought with her. She worried what would happen if she didn't leave a note. The notes were more for Janny than Greg, anyway. She bounced the duffel down the steps and onto the shoulder of the highway, followed it almost a quarter mile to the state line, where she planned to take the local bus to the Greyhound station in Ocean City. She would then head to Baltimore, although she couldn't stay long. She was too easy to find there. She would fall back into certain routines. An older man in a Cadillac offered her a ride to D.C., and she figured why not. Then he got pervy, his sad old fingers sneaking toward her knees like some arthritic spider, and she said, "Put me out here." It was Belleville, one of the 10 best small towns in America, according to a shiny, newish sign. Now, seeing Belleville in the bright morning light, she wonders what the other 9 are. She doesn't have much of a head start. Greg would have seen the note at noon or so when they came back for lunch. He was probably more upset that she hadn't made the mini sandwiches or set the table. He didn't love her, and she didn't love him. He had one foot out the door. He'd leave her, get an apartment. He'd never pay child support, not without endless nagging. She might even have to get a job. So why not go ahead and get a job, but let him have Janny? See what it's like to be a full-time parent. He wasn't going to trap her. When you've been in jail, even a short time, you don't like feeling confined. What next? She's thought a lot of things out, but she hasn't thought everything out. She has to earn some money, enough to head west by fall. She had assumed she'd do that in D.C., but maybe it's easier to do it here. Certainly she'll be harder to find. She walks into the town proper, down the main street, which is called Main Street. There is a deli, a grocery store called Langley's, a Purple Heart thrift store, a florist. But a lot of the shops are empty, long vacant by the looks of them. She doubles back to the motel, the bar she had chosen last night when she made her ride pull over. The Hi-Ho. Certainly it should be H-E-I-G-H-H-O, Hi-Ho. The guy in the bar last night was awfully good-looking. Kind of her type, not that she was interested. Still, she was surprised, even a little insulted, that he gave up so easy. A car seems to come out of nowhere, and she jumps, skittish. But it's too early for anyone to be looking for her. And anyway, it isn't against the law, leaving your family at the beach. She's surprised more women don't do it. She got the idea from a book she read 2 months ago. Well, she didn't actually read it, and she had been planning her own escape for a while. But everyone was talking about it, like it was a fantasy. If only you knew, she wanted to tell her neighbors along Kentucky Avenue, if only you knew what it means to walk away from something, what it takes. Money. She has some, she needs more. The guy last night, he liked her, she was sure. But she doesn't want to make that mistake anymore. She has enough money to go 2-3 weeks. Summer's coming. There are probably some seasonal jobs still open. She wonders when Greg will check the accounts, see how much money she moved out of their joint savings in that final week before their vacation. Half. which is what she was entitled to. The money will make him even madder than the fact that she left. At least Janny is a pretty easy kid, she wants to tell him. Imagine it otherwise. He can't. Greg can't imagine anything. Life unspools as Greg expects. Even the surprises, Janny, their marriage, don't surprise him. She used to be that kind of person. But she's not going to be. Not anymore. Back at the motel, she sees the guy from the bar leaning against the door jamb of room 3. Could be a coincidence. Everyone has a life. Everyone has something going on. Don't make the mistake of thinking everything is all about you, all the time. Hi, he says. He's the kind of guy who can get away with just that one word, hi. He's good-looking, in a bland way, and he probably thinks that's enough. Probably has been enough, with most women. She wiggles her fingers in a kind of greeting, but keeps her hand by her side, like he's not worth the effort of bending an elbow. He says, how long you staying over? Who wants to know? Every man in town, I'm guessing. So predictable. And not even true. She has a version of herself that catches men's eyes, but she's turned that off for now. Maybe forever. The only thing it ever got her was trouble. I'm Adam Bosk, he says. Like the pear, only with a K instead of a C.
I'm the pink lady, she says. Like the apple.
Think we can still be friends? Me a pear, you an apple?
I thought it was apples and oranges that can't be compared.
She walks past him and into her room. She doesn't come out again until the sun goes down, which means it's almost 8:30 before she emerges. Maybe some people would go crazy, sitting in a motel room, nothing to eat but a pack of peanut butter and cheese crackers she found in her purse. Mom food. Greg is going to have to learn tricks like that now. Janny's an easy kid until she gets hungry. Then, all bets are off. She enjoys the silence, the novelty of no one needing her. No voices calling, nothing to be cleaned, or cooked, or washed. She doesn't even put the television on, just lies back on the bed, steeping herself in silence. When she crosses the street, the sun huge and red as it sinks over the cornfields. She has a hunch he'll be there. Mr. Pear. He is. She makes sure there's a stool between them.
What are you having? He asks.
How much money do you have?
He laughs. They always think she's joking. Greg did, that's for sure. She wishes she could say, pay attention. I haven't even told you my name yet, but I'm telling you who I am, what I care about. As if privy to her thoughts, he asks,
what's your name, pink lady? Not that you'll be pink for long. There's a nice shade of brown under that burn. I didn't know redheads could tan like that.
What is her name? Which one should she use?
Polly Costello, she says. Chapter 3. Janny wakes up crying for her mother. She's only 3 years old. She can't understand what's happening. Greg barely understands. She asks Greg to read the note again, as if it might change since he read it last night, and yesterday at lunch, and yesterday morning, and the night before that. The note does change. He adds a little to it with each reading. An additional, I love you, Janny. Then the next time, I love you more than anything, Janny. Later, he thinks it might be a good idea to include, be good to Daddy, this is going to be even harder on him. Pauline's been gone only 2 days, and the note is already creased and worn. Janny holds it against her face, pressed between her cheek and her stuffed cat, when she goes to sleep. She goes to sleep crying. She wakes up crying. In between, she has nightmares that make her cry and mutter and moan, yet don't wake her. They wake Greg, though.
What kind of woman walks out on her family?
Greg knows. The kind of woman he picked up in a bar 4 years ago, precisely because she had that kind of wildcat energy. Pauline was supposed to be a good time, nothing more. She scratched, she bit, she was up for anything, anywhere, anytime. Then, in the middle of their summer fling, she peed on a stick, and a plus sign formed in the circle. But it might as well have been a cross, and he was up on it. Because it turned out she was a good girl all along. Good enough that she wouldn't think of having an abortion. Did not see that one coming. Plus, she was 31, and she figured this might be her last chance to have a kid. Maybe it was a sign, a destiny thing. They got married fast. It wasn't so bad at first. So much was happening. She said she didn't want a wedding because she had no people. It would just make her sad, her side of the church empty. So they got married at the courthouse and used the money that would have gone to a wedding to honeymoon in Jamaica, one of those resorts where everything was included. It was cheap because it was the last week of October, the tail end of hurricane season. They had to find a house big enough for what was going to be the three of them, and they lucked out on a bargain up near Herring Run Park, a snug little brick place, very respectable, all the old woodwork and leaded windows still intact. Janny arrived. A first for both of them. But Pauline was calm, while he was a mess. Now that he thinks about it, maybe that was the first sign that she wasn't right. Should any woman be that calm, taking care of her first baby? At the time, he thought it meant she was a natural mom. But maybe this was proof that she was the opposite. She is detached, removed, a caretaker, not a parent. The sex slowed after Janny was born, and it was still good enough that it made him angry that they didn't have more of it. She said that if he wanted more attention from her, he needed to help around the house. He wasn't raised to be that way. Greg had grown up without a father, and his mother had worked overtime, in and out of the house, to make sure he knew what was his due as a man. Pauline didn't even have a job. Why was she so tired? By the time Janny turned 2, Pauline was still tired, and the newness had worn off everything. Marriage, house, baby, her. There was nothing left to distract them from the fact that they just didn't like each other that much. Yet, the sex was still good. Looking back, he thinks she treated the sex like that was her job, a job she enjoyed. Listening to his friends at work, he felt smug at first because it wasn't that way with them. But now he knew that was another sign that she was unnatural. Once a woman became a mother, she wasn't supposed to be like that. Pauline was a dirty, dirty girl. She wasn't cut out to be a mother, a wife. How had he missed it? Then, Pauline had... It was hard to admit, even to himself. Pauline had started hitting him. During. It had started with him spanking her a little. Not hard, just for fun. A way to spice things up. She had howled all out of proportion to the pain, tried to scratch him with her nails. But when she calmed down, she asked if he wanted to see what it felt like. He didn't. But he didn't want to look as if he wasn't as bold as she was. She slapped his cheek. It hurt, but he didn't want to say how much because he couldn't let her be tougher than he was. Of course, he had reined himself in. Didn't use his full strength because that would be wrong. Whereas, she wasn't holding anything back. It stung. It was painful. It was exciting. Then, somehow about 2 months ago, the acrid fights of their day-to-day life spilled over into the sex, and even sex wasn't fun anymore. He had a co-worker, Mandy, who went to lunch with him, listened, and sympathized. He started staying out late, claiming he was working overtime. They were doing a lot of refis at work, so it was credible. Then,
He went home to Pauline, overflowing with this mysterious anger. He started dropping by the bar where he met Pauline, and yes, sometimes he took another girl out to the parking lot. The sex was never quite as good as what he had with Pauline in their early days, but it was better than what he had now, which was pretty much nothing. He had proposed this beach vacation as one last family get-together to see if they could find their way back. He spun the one-room studio rental as part of the plan, real togetherness, one big happy. But in the back of his mind, he was already thinking about moving out. His mom would take him in. He could always count on his mom. Now she's moved out, leaving him with the kid. There had been a separate note just to him, one that he had hidden from Janny. This note was cool and businesslike. A typed note, at that. Which means she had written it before they ever got here. Probably pecked it out at the library, where they had word processors. "I will let you know of my plans as soon as possible. I know you want a divorce, so let's make it quick and painless. For now, it's best if Janny remains with you, in the house and routine she knows. I will call after I'm settled." And now, it's Tuesday, their last day of vacation. He has trudged through the past 48 hours as if the end of this getaway was some sort of finish line. He cannot believe how hard it is to care for a child 24/7. Although he told himself that's because they're not at their house with all their stuff. Now, packing up to return home, he sees that life is just going to keep going. That he will have even more problems once he gets home. What will he do for childcare? He loves Janny, but Christ, he cannot be a single dad. There's a $125 penalty if you stay 1 minute past 11 a.m. on the last day of your rental, even on a Tuesday. Janny wanted one more morning at the beach, but Greg can't get them packed up and have the place clean enough to get his deposit back if they do that. Janny whines every second of the morning and shows a real talent for creating a mess wherever he has just cleaned, stepping in dust piles, leaving sticky prints on appliances, tables, walls. They get away with only minutes to spare, 10:57, on the dashboard clock. When he turns to check his sights as he backs the car out of the driveway, he sees Janny in her car seat, clutching that damn note to her cheek. Those dark curls, olive skin, light eyes. She looks nothing like her mother. If he hadn't been at the hospital when Janny was born, if he hadn't been there for the pregnancy, he'd wonder if a woman could somehow fake having a kid. Janny has looked exactly like him since day one. "That's evolution at work," Pauline told him. "If babies didn't look like their fathers, they'd reject them. She'll look more like both of us as time goes on. Well, it's 3 years later, and the little girl in the car seat still looks like a female version of him. Put their childhood photos next to each other, and you'd think they were fraternal twins. There's not a trace of her mother in her face." Pauline's not going to dump this kid on him. He'll find her, make her do right. He's the one who's supposed to be moving out, moving on. "Whore," he mutters.
"What, Daddy?"
"Nothing." 2 miles up the highway, he takes the left turn onto State Highway 26 too fast, and the boogie board he roped to the roof goes sliding off. Horns honk around him, as if he planned this fiasco. He'd leave the board on the roadside if he could, but that would make him no better than her. He pulls over and puts everything to rights, then fights for his way back into the westbound traffic, surprisingly thick for a Tuesday in June. Oh, God, there's a funeral. Apparently for the most popular guy in Bethany Beach, the line of cars, 20, 30 deep. He adds this mishap to the growing list of everything that's her fault. She has ruined his life. Or tried to. He'll find her. Make her fulfill her obligations, make her pay. He remembers the first slap, after he gave her permission, so hard it almost brought tears to his eyes. It was as if she had been waiting to hit him for a very long time. Chapter 4. Early in her first marriage. The less said about that, the better. Polly would get so upset at her husband that she would throw herself out of the car. At first, only at stop signs or traffic lights. Eventually, she started jumping out during a slow roll. Never more than 5 or 10 miles per hour. Usually in a parking lot. But there was a heady danger to it. Especially if one chose, as she did, to leap and try to land two-footed on the pavement. She never tucked and rolled, never scraped her hands. She wanted him to see her leap, turn, and head in the other direction, knowing he couldn't follow as nimbly. Then again, they both knew she had to come home eventually. Why couldn't she leave that marriage as easily as she jumped from his car? Part of it was money, of course. Walking home cost her nothing, except a beating. To leave, she would have needed money. Leaving required planning. The jump from the car was the opposite of a plan. It was a moment of possibility. I'm not trapped. I come back to you voluntarily. A lie. One she told only to herself, but an essential one in those days. A lie that she finally made true. But it took a long time. Time and money. Everything worth having requires time and money. Speaking of, she crosses the highway and enters the Hi-Ho slightly after 4. Early enough so it's quiet, not so early that she seems unreliable. A lot of drunks like to work in bars. A man she once knew, a guy who fancied himself a real sage, liked to say, "If you have a thing for elephants, you work in the circus. If you like little kids, you get jobs that give you access to them. Teaching, Cub Scouts, daycare. Drunks like to work in bars." Polly has been chatting up the barmaid 3 nights running now, getting a rapport going, all the while ignoring the guy who's staying at the motel same as her. Mr. Number 3, as she thinks of him, despite knowing his name. She overheard him telling the barmaid that his truck threw a rod, but he'll be gone once they find the part. "Any chance you can use someone else here?" Polly asks the barmaid. "Maybe part-time," she says. "On weekends and evenings, we need a waitress to help with the kitchen orders. But if you want work, you'll do better going east to the beaches. No matter how much they load up on staff down the ocean in summertime, it's never enough. And there's always someone who can't deal with the pace, the tourists. You'll make better money, too." "Why don't you work down there, then?" Polly takes out her pack of cigarettes, pushes it toward the woman, who helps herself to one. The barmaid has an apple-cheek prettiness, but she always smells of cigarettes, takes frequent breaks in the parking lot. Whereas Polly is that odd person who can take them or leave them. "That hour drive is just that much too far. If I lived in Seaford or Dagsboro, maybe, but not from here. I hate driving these two-lane roads at night. Kids going too fast on the curves, old people going too slow, speed traps. Rather make just enough every week of the year, stay away from the tourists. They don't tip well anyway. Everyone's passing through." Polly decides not to point out that she just said the money was better down the ocean. "What would I make here, part-time?" 4 nights a week, including one of the big weekend nights, maybe $200, mostly cash. But that's if you're good. Are you good?" "I think so. I wouldn't mind having a deeper bench, that's for sure. I'd like to take a weeknight off here and there, but it's the boss's decision." "What if I need to work off the books?" The barmaid's eyes narrow. "Why would you want to do that?" "Not a matter of want, need." "Someone looking for you?" "Not for anything I did wrong, but if I were to be found, yeah, it could be bad." She smiles. "I'm not the first woman to make a mistake, you know? Don't say too much and people will fill in the gaps, usually to your advantage." Polly has shown up out of nowhere, lives in a motel that rents by the week. She has a fading bruise on her jaw. That was actually from Janny's head jerking up, headbutting her by accident, but all anyone knows is that there is a purple-green shadow on the right side of her face. She touches it now,
absent-mindedly, then snatches her hand away, as if she doesn't want to draw attention to it. Funny, touching the bruise is almost like touching Janny. Smelling all those toddler smells. This is for the best, she reminds herself. Janny's going to be better off in the long run.
Let me talk to the boss. His name is Cosimo, but we call him Casper behind his back, Mr. C to his face.
Casper? He's white as a ghost. I'm Kath, by the way.
Nice to meet you, Kath.
Kath goes into the kitchen, doesn't come back. Time passes. 5 minutes, 10. Two men come in, older guys. Polly's seen them here before, drinking the cheapest draft beers. She walks behind the counter, pulls their drafts, writes down the transaction on a napkin. These guys always run a tab, she's pretty sure. When the barmaid returns with the boss, they find Polly still behind the bar. They don't like her presumption, but they don't mind it as much as they might. She has shown initiative.
So, you're ready to start?
Cosimo, Casper asks. Mr. C. He is really white. Blue-white. His skin almost glows, although he's not an albino. Maybe the closest thing you can be to one without being one.
Like, right now?
I was just trying to help out. I know these guys don't like to wait.
Yeah, what else you know about them?
That's Kath. He's Max, and he's Ernest. Polly indicates which is which with her chin. On weekends, they come in about 5, but on weekdays, they like to get started before the 5 o'clock news. They drink Natty Bow, they talk a lot about politics, and Agent Orange and DDT. They say food tasted better when they were allowed to use DDT, so I think one of them might be a retired crop duster, although maybe he just worked at DuPont. They also warned me that there's a gun in your desk drawer, so I better not think of lifting so much as a dollar out of the till. Mr. C. The bar flies cackle, nod, and Mr. C seems charmed by the use of his nickname. Men always like her, when she can be bothered to try. Kath seems less friendly now. Polly will need to watch for that. She has no use for women, which is why she has to make sure to befriend them. Women never like her. They feel threatened by her, which is silly. She'd never take another woman's man. Doesn't even want that much attention from men. The problem is, when a man wants her, he usually won't stop trying to get her. They wear her down, men. She starts off by taking pity on them, ends up feeling sorry for herself.
When can you start?
Mr. C asks.
When do you need me?
Let's try you out now. See how it goes.
When Mr. Number 3 comes in, there's now more space between them than before. The breadth of the bar, instead of a couple of stools. He wasn't counting on that, she can tell. But now she has to talk to him, indulge his quiet, not quite flirtation, because it's going to make the difference in where she sleeps, what she eats. Tips. You have to swallow a lot to make good tips. She's already started reading The Penny Saver, looking for a cheap place to live. Today she checked out a big apartment over the empty Ben Franklin store on Main. Walking distance from here, although it's not a great walk. A lot of highway with narrow shoulders, few sidewalks. The apartment's not anything special, but it's huge, and only $300 a month. She likes the idea of those two big empty rooms, only for her. She wouldn't fill it with furniture even if she could. She leans over the bar. Max and Ernest have already made the inevitable top-shelf jokes, snicker, snicker. It was strange how she got skinny but her breasts stayed the same size. But just because her breasts don't look as if they belong on her body, it doesn't mean they belong to the world, either. Every time she waitresses, she swears it's the last time. But she's good at it. And she loves taking home cash at night's end. There's nothing like cash.
So, you're sticking around?
Mr. Number 3 asks. Adam, the first man.
Only this one is into pears, not apples. For now.
You gonna keep living at the motel?
Probably not.
We'll miss you.
I'll come back to visit, if I'm invited.
She waits for him to pick up on the suggestion, the hint of a question mark. She tells herself that she's bored enough that she might as well take him up on the inevitable pass. She's going to end up with someone in town. Why not this Adam? It's a hard habit to break, gravitating to a protector. Even if she's never quite found the right one. She's like Goldilocks. The first one was too rough, the second too weak. But isn't it the third one that's always just right? Unless, of course, you break it, like Little Bear's chair. In her mind, she's already sitting on the edge of Adam's bed, drinking bourbon and Coke out of a plastic cup, stretching, arching her back, touching the back of his hand. Men are so easy. He doesn't ask her back. Screw him. Maybe she will do just that, after all. Chapter 5. When Polly, the pink lady, hints that she might be interested in being invited back to his place, Adam overreacts by not reacting. He plays dim, not a play he can carry. Maybe he should have let her come over. You don't have to sleep with a good-looking woman just because she comes to your motel room and has a drink after work. It's not a law or anything. Not that this one respects laws or rules. That's why he's here. And he was warned. She'll have sex with you if you get close to her. It's what she does. He has decided not to ask how the client could be so sure of this. Then again, this Polly doesn't always do what she's expected to do. Who could have predicted she would decamp in the middle of a beach vacation, just up and leave her family? The plan had been to make contact with the husband during the Fenwick trip, get to know him, do some man-on-man bonding. Oh, you live in Baltimore, whereabouts? I'm on the northeast side, too. The plan was to find out what the husband knew. Go figure. He knew less than nothing. Adam was thrown when she left the beach Sunday morning, went up to the house and packed her bags. Except, he must have had an inkling something was up. Because he left the beach, too. Kept watch on the house. Saw her come out and start dragging the duffel down the highway, then jump in that guy's car as he followed at a discreet distance. Luckily, there are only two ways west from the beach. Route 50 and 404. And almost everyone leaving the Delaware beaches takes 404. When she got out in Belleville, he did too. Good thing he always has an overnight bag in his truck, packed and ready to go. Sure, he had to drive back to Fenwick the next day and check out of his motel there, pick up the rest of his things, risking that she would move on in the interim. But she was there when he got back, hanging out at the Hi-Ho. Now she has a job at the bar, and she has all but invited herself into his bed, and he made the wrong move. She's pissed at him now. What can he do? He continues to go to the bar, continues to make it sound as if his truck is like some goddamn Maserati that can't be easily serviced, even in big town Salisbury. She pulls his drafts with as little commentary as possible. The two old guys get more attention, and they barely tip. Her cold shoulder isn't obvious. She's too much of a pro to frost a regular. She neutralizes him. That's the perfect word. He's invisible. An outline of his former self. Drinking beer, leaving a respectable tip at night's end. Over-tipping would be a mistake, even if it's not his money. She's ignoring him. He's ignoring her, ignoring him. It's exhausting and much less fun than their slow dance toward each other when they were on the same side of the bar.
It makes him think of a Japanese horror film he saw as a kid, one that no one else seems to remember. He describes it all the time to people and never gets a flash of recognition. The setup was like the blob, only it was a stream of hot atomic liquid that flowed through the streets of Tokyo. And if it touched you, that was it. You were a goner. You were vaporized in a flash. How much longer can he linger here in Belleville? Fate intervenes in the form of a cardboard box of San Marzano tomatoes that someone left in a damp spot. The case, weakened by moisture, breaks open. The cans drop in quick succession on the line cook's foot, ill-protected in flip-flops, of all things. The poor guy might have survived the broken toe, but not the index finger, sliced open by the knife he inadvertently grabbed as he fell. The owner, Mr. C., although Adam has yet to learn what the C is for, puts up a sign looking for temporary help. Kath says the boss can cook, in a pinch, but he prefers not to in the summer. Hard to figure what he does with his days, given how ghostly pale he is. So, Adam's after-school job in Uncle Claude's diner in San Mateo, his time at the CIA, Culinary Institute of America, not the spy agency, is gonna save this gig. He also spent a season cooking on a rich guy's yacht, but his instincts tell him not to share that part of his resume. Mr. C takes the help wanted sign down after talking to Adam for 5 minutes. He says he'll do most of the cooking, use Adam for the scut work, but he's lazy, and by the third day, he's letting Adam do everything. Customers begin saying nice things about the food. Adam, who can't phone anything in, pushes Mr. C to upgrade some of his suppliers, to let him use local produce when possible, although it's still early for tomatoes, and spend a little extra on the things that matter, like beef and seafood. Cheap chicken is fine. People who order a chicken sandwich in a place like this have no taste buds. Besides, the locals seldom order chicken. Adam can't figure if this is out of fealty to the Kiwanis, who sell barbecue by the roadside on weekends, or because this is chicken country. You drive past those long, low coops, inhale. It puts you off chicken. All due respect, Mr. Perdue. Business picks up, which is good for everyone. Mr. C needs both waitresses most nights, one for lunch. The tips are bigger. And through it all, Adam keeps it mild and professional with the new barmaid, Polly Costello. "Polly want a cracker?" he says, shaking a bag of oyster crackers at her, deliberately being cornpone. It doesn't get a smile. "Is Polly short for something?" "No," she says. They don't speak again. Beyond the shorthand of short order speak, Adam and Eve on a raft, etc. Their first real conversation begins with an argument over a steak. Customer orders it medium rare, then complains it's too red. "That's what medium rare is," he tells her, maybe with a little more heat than the situation requires. "Medium has some pink. If there's no hint of pink, it's on its way to being medium well. Truly rare is closer to blue, maybe a bluish purple." "The customer is always right," she says. "You don't believe that." "I believe that the customer leaves the tip, and the tip is my real pay, so the customer is my boss." "And you're not," she's telling him. "Like a little kid. You're not the boss of me." "But I'm here day in, day out. Your customer will only be as happy as my food makes him."
"The food was shitty before you got here. It'll be shitty after you leave. I'm not worried about the food."
"So you think my food is good?" He can't help feeling a little flattered.
"I didn't say that. It's not as bad as it was. It's okay. I wouldn't know. I don't eat meat."
"I can make you a nice salad."
"I don't eat salad."
"You don't eat meat. You don't eat salad. What do you eat?"
She doesn't bother to answer. "Look, please cook it a little more. Is that so hard?"
That's all I needed to hear, please. Was that so hard?
The kitchen closes at 9:30. The bar goes to 11, but Adam, a neat freak who obsesses over the hood, needs that long to clean and prep for the next day. When Polly closes the register at 10:55, he slides a plate across the bar to her. It's the most perfect grilled cheese and tomato sandwich that ever was. The brown stripes on the buttery white bread are so perfectly symmetrical they could have been put there by a painter. Inside, there is finely chopped bacon, his own secret. Fry the bacon, then chop it. Otherwise, it tears up the sandwich as you bite, fights the cheese, gets stuck in your teeth. He mixes it with some bacon paste, calculating there may be a day when he wants to add this to the menu. The version he prepares for Polly is about as practical as a hand-whittled clothespin. On the side, fries made from fresh potatoes, not the ones in the freezer, blanched in 250-degree oil, then sprinkled with rosemary. A cup of ketchup, but also a cup of homemade aioli. Although he'll call it mayo on the board. With good fries, you want mayo. She eats without commentary. She eats every bite, though.
There was bacon in there, he says.
I know, she says. You testing me? My sister's a vegetarian, and she says she misses bacon every day. I didn't say I was a vegetarian. I said I didn't eat meat.
I just thought I knew what you would like.
You thought that, huh? She eats a French fry. The busboy dishwasher, Jorge, is working in the back, a cramped space, overwhelmed by the beat-up wolf with six burners, a broken salamander, a deep fryer that Adam loves, and a microwave he detests, but relies on more than he likes to admit. They're not really alone. Adam reminds himself, they're not alone.
This was nice of you, she says.
Thanks.
What do you want?
Nothing. That was just lagniappe, as they say in New Orleans. A little extra something-something. She laughs, as if that's the most ridiculous thing she's ever heard. A man wanting nothing from her.
You've been kind of standoffish with me. Like we got off on the wrong foot or something. And it's nicer if people who work together get along.
We get along fine. Every instinct warns him not to reference that one night, when he didn't ask her back to his room. In fact, he has to turn it around, make it a story about how she gave him the brush off. Her pride demands this. In her head, that might already be the story.
Look, you're a good-looking woman. You can't blame men for getting a little mopey around you.
She's interested now.
Mopey? That's your word for it? I worry you're going to make me your friend, tell me all about the guy you really like.
Not really in the market for a boyfriend, she says. He thinks there's a pause between the two words. You still at the motel?
Yeah.
With rent, as cheap as it is in this town? You could do better. You should see my place. It's huge.
I'd like that, to see your place.
One day. Bait. I need some furniture. Can you get off next Saturday during the day?
Hook. Maybe.
It will be hard, but if he comes up with a good excuse, promises to be there for the dinner rush, it should be okay. They don't really do a good lunch business on Saturday, so Mr. C could be persuaded to cook. Schools are out and the roads are clogged with traffic because most of the weekly rentals change over on Saturday. Locals can barely get out of their driveways on the weekends. The people bound for the beach are too close to those salty sea breezes to stop by the time they reach Belleville, while those who are headed home
feel as if they're too early in their journey to abandon their momentum. And next weekend is the beginning of the long 4th of July weekend, so the traffic will be worse than usual. There's an auction over to Mardella Springs. I might be able to pick up a few things I need for my new place, but I'd need someone strong. Someone with a truck. You drive a truck. A big one, right?
Pretty big, he says.
Well, let me know if you can get off on Saturday. She has eaten every bite of the food he put in front of her. The plate barely needs to go in the dishwasher. Who eats like that and has a figure like hers? He finds himself thinking of the folk tales his mother liked to tell him. Greek and Roman mythology wasn't enough for Lillian Bosque. She had studied Slavic languages, written a dissertation on Eastern European folk tales. She loved to tell him about the Allah